This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The Grand Canyon, the swampy Everglades, and the rolling mountains along the Blue Ridge Parkway. These are just a few of the many natural areas preserved by the National Park Service. The federal agency turns 100 today. It celebrates a legacy of protecting more than 400 areas across the country. Today, these sites include parks, seashores, monuments, and more. North Carolina is home to some of the most visited spots in the country. But growing environmental concerns are threatening the Park Service's preservation efforts. Joining me now is Stuart Pym. He's a professor of conservation ecology at Duke University. Welcome back, Stuart Pym. Good to have you.
Thank you so much, Frank. Always like being on the show.
National parks, 100 years old today. Take us back. What was the instinct to create these parks, and how has the system evolved?
100 years ago, it was Yellowstone out in the west, a place that seemed magic and magically remote, a time when only 100,000 people lived in Wyoming, and few people could imagine ever going there. But there was a sense that it was an international treasure, and it needed to be protected. And that spirit of protecting these wonderful places has grown and grown and grown. And the Great Smoky Mountains National Park have been with us for about 80 years or so. So we in North Carolina have been at the cutting edge of protecting our heritage.
Well, treasure had two very different definitions, particularly coming at the height of the industrial movement in the United States. Treasure meant exploitation. Use it, don't preserve it.
Yeah, and I think this is why it's such an interesting change, that the Smokies were established by people who felt that every last tree in the Appalachians was going to be cut, and they wanted to stop that, and they wanted to protect those trees, protect that wilderness, protect these special places. And 10 million visitors a year proved them right.
Yeah, by a factor of two, greater than the next largest, the Grand Canyon's second most visited, and they've got 5 million a year, so it's huge here. And as you point out, the movement begins west, comes back east, and now we see more visitors here in North Carolina than any place else.
I suspect we in North Carolina get more visitors to parks than anybody else, with the Blue Ridge, the Smokies, the Cape Hatteras. This is the center of national parks.
So what condition are these parks in today?
Well, estimates are that the national parks are about $12 billion in the hole in terms of the resources that they need. The Park Service costs about $3 billion a year to run. That's whatever that is, 10 bucks a person per year. It brings in $100 a person profit in the sense of what people spend in the local communities. But it's pretty obvious, if you're able to speak to park superintendents and other workers as I have done, that we need more investment, that the infrastructure is falling apart. And there are threats to the seashores as sea level rises, threats to pollution, threats to lots more people wanting to come and visit them that need to be managed and shepherded and educated. We want to make sure that the parks are open to a much wider section of society that needs to have greater access.
And, of course, we started talking about Western North Carolina, but as you just mentioned, Cape Hatteras is an important part of this. So talk about what's going on along the coast and, again, some of the needs.
Well, I think we all enjoy wild places, and the seashores are such places. So the challenge there is people want to drive along the beach, and I can understand why, to get away from it all. But there are birds and turtles that nest on those beaches. There are people who want the beaches to walk on. It's a not atypical challenge of how we manage different constituencies in an era where national park visits now total 300 million people a year. Essentially, every American visits a national park once a year. So as more people impact these areas, how do we trade off between the different constituencies?
And that's the impact of population and trying to manage these areas in the face of a growing demand. And as you say, a real economic payback.
There's a huge payback. I don't know, 20 years ago, there was a government shutdown and they shut the national parks down. The last government shutdown, it was very clear that nobody, absolutely nobody wanted to shut the parks down. They bring in a huge amount of money, something probably on the order of $100 billion a year of income. You want that revenue flowing into the local communities that provide food, housing, all the other things.
We've been talking about some of the environmental needs here in North Carolina, but let's take a look across the country. Some of the environmental challenges, climate change, I guess, would be number one.
Climate change is a major one. It affects the Everglades because it's low-lying. It affects our coastlines in North Carolina. You know, Glacier National Park may not have a glacier to celebrate if trends continue. And then most of the Western National Parks are quite dry forests. And as climate warms, fire frequencies go up. You only have to watch the news at the moment to see that happening.
What about air pollution? Let's come back here to North Carolina, but you can take us nationally as well. What kind of impact does that have?
Well, I think we're all aware of images of the Blue Ridge, and it's not always clear as we'd like to be. We still burn a lot of fossil fuels in the Ohio Valley. That creates pollution. I think many of us would like to find alternative, cleaner, renewable sources of energy, which would be good for our health and good for our psychology as we look over cleaner landscapes rather than dirtier ones.
Well, we call it the Smoky Mountains. That covers that whole problem up, right?
I do not think that covers the whole problem up, Frank.
Okay. So what about the future? Where do you see it going? Again, there are these competing interests. I mean, obviously there are some conservative, particularly we're talking about big business interests for exploitation, pressing against the forest. On the other hand, much more local spread out businesses benefit by them. Where do you see, how do you see the politics playing out?
You know, we elect our politicians to make wise decisions. And that means I do not expect them to cater to narrowly defined interests against the wider interests of lots of people. And I do see issues like that in Florida with the Everglades and other places too. The parks are incredibly good value for money. The small amount of money people pay to visit them doesn't capture what they provide for us. I think, and if I may make a plug, we're going to have a new Park Institute for America based at Duke. And one of the things we're hoping to do is to agitate more for appropriate, sensible management of our national parks.
Well, joining me now to look at some of the national parks in Western North Carolina is Karen Chavez. She's an outdoors reporter with the Asheville Citizen Times and covers the area's national parks and joins us from WCQS in Asheville. Karen, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You cover the Great Smoky Mountains and the Blue Ridge Parkway, and that's a lot of territory. Tell us about these two sites. Again, I think we talked about them in terms of visitors. What about the economic impact of these visitors on the area?
Well, it's pretty huge. A study last year showed that visitors to the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, which is the most visited, and it had nearly 11 million visitors last year, those visitors spent about $806 million and supported nearly 13,000 jobs. And the Blue Ridge Parkway, which is the most visited site in the entire national park system, last year had more than 15 million visitors. And those visitors spent nearly $1 billion and supported more than 15,000 jobs.
Wow, and the Blue Ridge Parkway recently acquired more land around the parkway. What effect is that going to have on the area?
Well, it was about 5,000 acres, and it was just announced on Tuesday near the Water Rock Knob area of the Blue Ridge Parkway, which is in Haywood County. And these lands were all high elevation, over 6,000 feet in elevation, and have spectacular views. And, you know, that was part of why the parkway was built back in the 30s, was to provide a scenic drive, a scenic roadway. And so this will just provide more opportunities for people to get those beautiful views.
You heard Stuart Pym talk about a $12 billion shortfall in what it takes to maintain the parks nationally. And the park, the Blue Ridge Parkway and the Great Smokies, is struggling as well. Tell us about that backlog and the way it's affecting upkeep.
Yeah, these are the most visited national parks and also have some of the highest deferred maintenance backlogs in the country. Unfortunately, the Blue Ridge Parkway is looking at about $517 million in deferred maintenance. So things like road repairs, campgrounds, buildings, facilities, trails. Those things are just not getting taken care of as they should be. And in the Smokies, it's about $232 million backlog.
Karen Chavez is an outdoors reporter with the Asheville Citizen-Times and covers the area's national parks. Karen, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you.
I also spoke with Stuart Pym, a conservation ecology professor at Duke University. Stuart, thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Just ahead, we're going to take a look at the Park Service's relationship with other communities. We'll talk about all of those communities on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking today about the National Park Service on its 100th birthday. Joining me now is Mickey Fearn. Mickey is the former deputy director of the National Park Service. One of his roles was to improve the relationship between communities of color in the Park Service. He's now a professor of parks, recreation, and tourism management at NC State University. Mickey Fearn, welcome to the State of Things.
Good morning.
What? Tell us about the Park Service relationship with people of color before you became deputy director.
First, let me say happy birthday to the National Park Service, and let's don't forget that North Carolina State Parks also celebrates 100 years this year. So I just want to say happy birthday to both of those organizations. I think when we look at the situation, it's a very complex kind of situation. When you look at the National Park Service workforce, it's 80% white. When you look at non-international visitors, they're 80% white. When you look at the seasonal workforce is 80% white. So you could look at it and say very clearly that for some reason the National Park Service and people of color in American society haven't met. And there are lots of explanations for that. I don't think it necessarily changed remarkably as a result of me being there. I think it will change as a result of the way that we started to look at some things.
Well, what were those things? Go ahead. Yeah, because I was going to ask you sort of what are the barriers and why you think that disparity existed.
Well, when John Jarvis became director of the National Park Service, by the way, I met John Jarvis when he was superintendent of Mount Rainier, and the question he was asking me then is why African-American people from Seattle didn't go to Mount Rainier. So he's been concerned about this for an awful long time. I think one of the things you have to look at about how people use their free time is that when you have free time and you have time, money, and energy, you do a calculation of something called return on investment. For the amount of time, energy, and money I have, what is the greatest payout I'm going to get for that? And if you look at people of color in American society, based on their experience or relationship with national parks, I think they were fairly unable to calculate that return on investment. And it's something that you don't calculate unless you've been there. My wife and I lived in Oakland, California for 8 years, and Yosemite was 4 hours away. And we would think about going, and we would say, well, it just can't be that pretty to drive 4 hours to go to a very crowded place. It just can't be that pretty. And that's a calculation of return on investment. Of course, when I went as deputy director, it was that pretty. And now I can make that calculation and share that with other people. So the calculating the return on investment is a huge problem. And I think we also have to look at in American society how race and class affects how people use discretionary time. because African Americans don't go to national parks, but they also don't play a lot of tennis, a lot of golf, a lot of scuba diving. So it's just not about national parks. It's about how race and class affect how people make decisions about their free time.
Well, let's get back to the calculation that you made, because, you know, you could imagine that all things being equal, there would be a proportionate percentage of people who say 4 hours is too far to go see a tree. And so then my question to you is, what are the factors in your calculation that are different based on race or class that another individual might see differently? There have to be different factors to come up with a different answer in your calculation. What are those factors?
Sure, and that's one of the great things about the national park system. They touch something that is human in all of us, and then there are sort of idiosyncratic or special differences based on culture and ethnicity. I want to say that one of the things that the environmental movement and a lot of other people have been guilty of is something called the homogenization of diversity. And that is, they look at all people of color as one big group of people and decide that generic solutions will address all those people. And by the way, nothing could be further from the truth. The reason that Native Americans don't go to national parks is different than the reasons Hispanics don't go, is different than the reasons immigrants don't go, is different than the reason that African Americans don't go. My particular study when I was at the National Park Service, when I interviewed for the job, people in the interior asked me, what am I going to do to get more black people camping and hiking? And I said, well, I'm not really all that interested in camping and hiking. What I want to find out is how a group of people who had a profound ancestral relationship with nature in Africa had that relationship totally disrupted and destroyed to the degree that now they're either afraid of nature or indifferent about it. That's what I want to find out, because that's what has to be corrected. So in the case of African-American people, there are these concepts called biophilia, which is love of nature, and biophobia, which is fear of nature. In their ancestral environment, it's a generalization, but I think we can be fairly certain that African people in their ancestral environment had a profound biophilic relationship with nature. But then a series of things happened. Violent separation from their homeland, the Middle Passage, slavery, the destruction of social systems, oral tradition, and family structure, brutality and violence, forced labor, the reversal of Reconstruction promises, Jim Crow, urbanization, the Northern migration, redlining, all of those things contributed to this estrangement from nature. And then the Northern migration, when urban African American people began to choose recreation activities, they began to choose activities in which they use their environment as a primary vehicle for participation, which would be streets and those kinds of things in inner city. So the separation from nature happened because of all of those things, and that's why we have to be very, very careful about how we create solutions relative to how people get there. Native Americans don't attend because of displacement. These parks were their homes, and there's a certain amount of bitterness and resentment about that. Hispanics for a totally different reason. But you really have to look at the ethnicities and cultures to be able to determine why they don't go, and then to be able to determine what it would take to get them to go.
Another cultural distinction that you point out is the fact that if you go back to these ancestral relationships with nature, the idea of the biosphere, the natural world in which you live, is not one that has to be necessarily preserved, because it's the air you breathe, it's literally in the ground you walk on, that in some ways preserving nature in the wilderness is a kind of modern concept and a white concept that doesn't necessarily translate well with ancestral cultural values.
Yeah, sure. The development of wilderness goes all the way back to the societies of Greece and Rome, where the urban environments would be very dense, where there wasn't a lot of beauty. And so aristocrats and very wealthy people would set aside beautiful parts of their countries so that they could go there and restore themselves from the drains of the city. They also believed that if they set aside these very beautiful places, that their god or gods would come to rest in those places. They didn't believe that God would come and rest in an urban area. So that was their motivation for setting it aside. But for Africans, for some Asians, for Hispanics, and for Native Americans, there was no distinction between wilderness and home.
So what have you done? What did you do? What ideas did you have to turn things around? And are things changing?
I think things are changing. The vision of John Jarvis when he came in was that the National Park Service could be relevant long before it is compliant. So there's a workforce that's 80% white. If the National Park Service hired all people of color in every position for the next 5 years, they still wouldn't be at compliance. But we can't wait until we have that compliance in the workforce to become relevant to all human beings. So John Jarvis's belief is that our organization will become relevant when the programs, products, services, and services establish a personal connection between traditional and new users, and that they understand that that has undeniable value and meaning in their life. So that's the approach we begin to take. We begin to look at programmatic aspects of National Park Service work to make sure that we were trying to get to the communities that were underserved. Now, historically, the way that played out is that we would invite people of color to come to national parks for what's called play dates. We'll invite you to come camping for the weekend. And we're thinking that if we invite you to come camping for the weekend, that will turn you on to nature, that will inspire you to add this to your recreation inventory. But what we know is that it takes 4 hits for somebody to introduce themselves into a recreation activity and then incorporate that activity into their recreation inventory. So what we were doing is these one-off experiences where we invite people for play dates. The other approach we were taking was to get young people of color who live in cities to work on what's called CORES. And those CORES are like the Civilian Conservation Corps was. And they take them out to these places and they build bridges or do trails. But all that it turned into was like cheap labor. So we had to move away from the idea of a play date, and we had to move away from the idea of cheap labor and begin to develop programs and experiences that actually turn people on to what national parks do. So we created immersion experiences where we take kids for a month to all of the parks in the area, not just the national parks, but in Miami, the local parks, the regional parks, the state parks, and the national parks, and to make sure that the agencies are giving them the right kind of introduction to it, not just taking them out there and just leaving them there. In Raleigh, we created a program called the Neighborhood Ecology Corps, where we paid 20 young people $500 a year to be environmentalists in their neighborhood. And it's a partnership between North Carolina State, the Center for Human Earth Restoration, North Carolina State Parks, the National Park Service, and Raleigh Parks and Recreation, where we've taken these 20 kids to places that most people in North Carolina wouldn't even see. Mm. But we take them to these places with the idea of them taking their learnings from these places and coming back and using those learnings to improve the quality of life in their neighborhoods. We also created something called an Urban Archaeology Corps, because we were trying to understand why there are no African-American people in the National Park Service archaeology program. So we got 5 high school students from Washington, D.C., and created an Urban Archaeology Corps, and now there are more than 50 people involved in that. But we're getting people involved in meaningful ways that both expand their recreation inventories, their career inventories, and improve the quality of life in their communities.
Mickey, what about sites like the Trail of Tears or one dedicated to Harriet Tubman or Cesar Chavez? Very briefly, can you give us a sense of whether or not that's had an impact?
Sure. And it's an interesting thing about the difference between why people of color go to national parks and why white people go to national parks. This whole thing started back around 1977 when they were talking about doing the Japanese internment camps as national and state parks. And people were saying people go to parks to be inspired. They don't go to parks to be remembered or to remember past injustices. And that's when state parks and national parks begin to realize that what we're about is telling the truth. And they realize, as painful as those experiences were, the Trail of Tears, Manadoka, Brown versus Board of Education, Central High School, as painful as those things are, going to those places for those cultures is a part of a healing process for them, and they want to experience the story, and they want the story to continue to be told.
Well, Mickey Fearn, we're going to take a little turn in the conversation to talk about other experiences in the parks. And here to talk about some of North Carolina's parks and their relationship with the surrounding communities is Tim Barnwell. He's a photographer from Asheville, been taking pictures of Appalachia for more than 30 years, and has a new book called Great Smoky Mountain Vistas. And he joins us from WCQS in Asheville as well. Hello, Tim.
Hello, Frank. Thank you.
You spent decades taking pictures of the national parks in western North Carolina and the residents nearby. How do local residents feel about the parks?
Well, I think there's a history there. I mean, you have the when the national park, Great Smoky Mountains National Park, was created in the mid-30s and dedicated in 1940, a lot of the families were moved out of areas like Cataloochee Valley, Cades Cove. Some decided to move into area communities in Haywood County around Cataloochee Valley, for instance. Others, like in Cades Cove, took lifetime leases. A few of them stayed. They were limited in what they could do there. They couldn't log and things like that, but they could hunt for themselves and they could basically continue to live there, but most moved out. So there's a lot of people, for instance, in Cataloochee Valley, you have communities that go back in August every year and do a dinner on the grounds at one of the churches in Little Cataloochee, and all the descendants take care of the graves and do that sort of thing and take care of the church and do repairs and all. So they're still allowed to come in and do that once a year on areas like that. So it cuts both ways. There's a lot of people that were displaced, had family members that were displaced several generations ago. But I think overall, you have this wonderful affection for the parks because we are fortunate in western North Carolina. I can be on the Blue Ridge Parkway 10 minutes from my house. I can be in the Great Smoky Mountains camping in an hour and 15 minutes. These are just terrific resources for our communities.
In the process of doing your work, you spent a lot of time with the residents there and have a lot of stories to tell, including the time you attended a river baptism with a church and then went to the family cemetery. Tell us that story.
Yes, I've been working on a project that manifests itself as the Face of Appalachia book, but it was early 80s, and I was asking around for different activities that I wanted to photograph, and so I kind of put the word out among people in the community what I was looking for, and one of them was the river baptism. A lot of them were done at what's called Forks of Ivy, which are local river section here, so I assumed it would be that, but I got a call one day from a lady, and she said, well, we're going to do one at our church, and I hadn't been to her church before. I knew where it was, and I said, well, are you going to go to the Forks of Ivy? She says, oh, no, we're going to do it next to the church here. And so when I got there, what they had done is taken a backhoe and basically just dug a pit out where the culvert came through underneath the road there and made this pool in November. And so they baptized probably a dozen young folks in there. And then it was an all-day event. That was a wonderful thing because you had the baptism after the church service in the morning, and you had the men kind of the senior men sitting on one side of the church and the older women sitting on the other side of the church, and the families all down the center. And they had kind of a gospel group made up of all the people that were in that audience and members of the congregation. And then they would go do the baptism, and you had just everybody kind of crowded around the creek watching their relatives being baptized. And then a dinner on the ground, so they would have everybody brought picnic lunches and fried chicken and all the stuff that you associate with those kinds of things, and just had this wonderful afternoon. And then they go up to the cemetery, which is on the hillside behind the church, and they would decorate the graves with usually plastic flowers or whatever. And that's kind of a tradition that's done with the mountain cemeteries every year, different months for different churches.
You also had a moving moment when you photographed a farmer with his steer and then later met his wife. Tell us about that.
Well, that was Collie Payne, and he had a steer named Barry. And I went to visit him. A friend of mine took me to visit him, and he lived up on the side of a cliff. Basically, we had to park down at the road and carry all of my gear, which was a 4x5 view camera at that time, which is this large box camera that you would have your head under the hood, and the image would be upside down and backwards. And so it was 40, 50 pounds of stuff. So I'm carrying it up to the cabin, and he and his wife come out and introduce themselves and just had this wonderful relationship. And so I photographed the two of them standing on the steps there on their cabin porch. And then I went with him up to the barn, which was up another switchback and real steep here. And he brought this steer out, which is just monstrous size. And he was not a big man himself, so it kind of even accented the size of the steer even more. And then we took it up to the top of the mountain, which is where the only open place was that he could have a field. And he had a tobacco field there. And he could talk to it and make it do anything he wanted. His doctor had told him he needed to slow down, so his idea of slowing down was getting rid of his mule and getting a steer and teaching it how to plow. So, he had a 16-year-old steer that he had plowed with for 14 years. And I set up and was getting everything ready, and it took a while because of the camera setup. And then finally, you know, he looks at me and says, "Okay, Barry, look at the camera." And, you know, steer just swung his head right up at me and stopped, you know, and I just fired the shutter, and it's just amazing. And not that he knew what he was saying, I don't know, but, you know, the beast and the man definitely had more communication than G and Hall, you know, go and stop, going for him. But then when I always take pictures back to people, and one of the things that I did was when I took photographs back to give them what I had shot, his wife just started crying, and I thought I'd done something wrong. And it turns out that other people had come and photographed him because he was locally a celebrity, I guess, for what he was doing, and the local papers had covered him to some extent. But I was the first person that had photographed them together, and she wanted a picture of them together. And it taught me a lesson early on to really pay attention to stuff like that, and don't overlook situations and don't get so locked into one way of doing things that you miss, you know, something very obvious like their affection for each other.
Tim Barnwell, what a pleasure. Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Tim Barnwell is a photographer from Asheville, been taking pictures of Appalachia for more than 30 years, has a new book called Great Smoky Mountain Vistas, and joined us from member station WCQS in Asheville. Also with me, Mickey Fearn. Mickey is the former deputy director of the National Park Service, now a professor of Parks, Recreation, and Tourism Management at NC State. Coming up, the answer to the question, what is life? Stay tuned.